I want to begin by reading some provocative words written by Eugene Peterson entitled Run with the Horses. In this book, he writes, "There is little to admire and less to imitate in the people who are prominent in our culture. We have celebrities, but not saints. Neither the adventure of goodness nor the pursuit of righteousness ever gets headlines. If, on the other hand, we look around for what it means to be a person of integrity, we don't find very much. They aren't easy to pick out. No journalist interviews them. No talk show features them. They're not admired. They're not looked up to. They do not set trends. There is no cash value in them. No Oscars are ever given for integrity. At year's end, no one compiles a list of the 10 best lived lives. The truth is, the world does not notice the lives of people that ought to be noticed. The truth of the matter is, neither does the church very well either. Frankly, part of our fallen nature as people is to overlook the accomplishments of others, to ignore the ministry of others and the service rendered on our behalf. People are all around us who serve us and make our lives possible and easier, and we rarely even notice. I found the rather interesting little story of a fella who, it says of him, he came home from work to find total mayhem in his house. His three children were outside, still in their pajamas, playing in the dirt. The door to his wife's minivan was open, as was the front door to the house. Proceeding into the entry, he found an even bigger mess. A lamp had been knocked over, and the throw rug was wadded against one wall. In the front room, the TV was loudly blaring, and the family room was littered with toys and several items of clothing. In the kitchen, dishes were overflowing the sink. Breakfast food was spilled on the counter. Dog food was spilled on the floor. Broken glass lay under the table, and a small pile of sand was spread by the back door. He quickly ran upstairs, stepping over toys, looking for his wife, worried that she was ill or that something serious had happened. He discovered her in the bedroom, still curled in the bed in her pajamas, reading a novel. There was a half-eaten bagel and a couple of coffee cups on the bedstand, and she looked up, smiled, and asked how his day went. He looked at her bewildered and said, "What happened here today?" And she smiled again and said, "Well, you know, every day when you come home from work, you ask me, what in the world did I do all day? Well, today I didn't do it." Somebody say, "Preach it, Stephen." Oh, my. Even those closest to us rarely know, right? Think about it. When's the last time you went to a movie and then stayed there and watched the credits scroll by? Indian Scout number 43, Indian Scout number 44, and you wanted to see their name. And that musical score that so moved you, you thought was so beautiful, did you stay and wait to see the name of the composer appear on the screen? Probably not. Show's over. On to the next event. That's how we are. That's why I find it so interesting that at the end of Nehemiah chapter 6, when the show is basically over, the walls are up, the gates are hinged. Next event, it's at this point that Nehemiah stops and under the divine inspiration of the Spirit of God begins to roll the credits and take notice of people by name. We don't even have time to read all of their names, but I want to look with you at some of them this morning. Inside this chapter, and by the way, chapter 11, you might want to open to both of those chapters, you find some wonderful truths tucked away in these credits. So let's follow evidently what God wanted Nehemiah to give us before we run with our empty popcorn bucket and head for the door, and let's take a look at some great truths to men and women who made Jerusalem happen. The first group of people mentioned in the credits are in verse 1. Let's read there in chapter 7. "Now it came about when the wall was rebuilt and I had set up the doors and the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed that I put Hananiah, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem." So he mentions here initially these singers and gatekeepers and Levites. If you turn over to chapter 11, you'll notice in verse 22, the latter part, there's some clear guidelines for the singers. At least we're told the sons of Asaph were the singers for the service of the house of God, for there was a commandment from the king that is going back to the kings of Israel concerning them, and firm regulation for the song leaders day by day. Now remember, for years, people of Israel have not been singing. There isn't anything to sing about when you're in captivity. In fact, Psalm 137 reflects their attitude as the psalmist says, "We sat down by the rivers of Babylon and wept." Babylon was the nation that took them into captivity. "We hung our harps on the branches of the willow trees." We don't need musical instruments. We're not singing, we're weeping. But here, now nearly 200 years later, they're tuning up their instruments. The choirs are being reformed. There's going to be music in the holy city of God. Once again, music, ladies and gentlemen, is not incidental. It is essential to worship. In the book of Nehemiah, you'll discover 8 references to giving thanks to God. They are now praising Him, and that is done through music like nothing else. Some very challenging words from a man named Edwin Deibler, a faculty member of years ago at Dallas Seminary. Dallas Seminary had a 50th anniversary a number of years ago, and they collected hymns and put them into a hymnal that was published entitled Hymns of Jubilee, hymns collected by the faculty and students. Deibler wrote in the prologue of that hymnal these words: "From earliest times, the people of God have employed music to give expression of their adoration of the triune God. Succeeding generations of Christians to our present day have adapted poetry set to music to pour out their adoration, praise, aspirations, and prayer." And listen to these words: "Often, perhaps nearly always, such praise has exceeded in intensity the actual lifestyles of the congregations who sing them." He goes on to challenge us by saying, "If Christian experience were, even for a period of 1 week, brought up to the level of our Christian hymns, a great revival would sweep over the world." I find it fascinating, men and women, that before the revival occurs in Nehemiah chapter 8, and we'll look at that at another time, in Nehemiah chapter 7, you have the musicians recalled and the choirs reformed. The singers will provide the praise for the city of God. There's another group that was mentioned that will provide the protection for the city of God. They're mentioned in chapter 7, and also there in chapter 11, where you perhaps are in verse 19, it says the gatekeepers, their names were Akub and Talmon and their brethren who kept watch at the gates, and there were 172 of them. "Hey, Akub, what do you do?" "Hey, Talmon, what is it that you do in the city of God?" "Oh, I'm a gatekeeper. I open the gates in mid-morning, and then I close them at night. And in between, I watch carefully so that enemies of God don't steal in numbers of twos and threes carrying weapons. We guard the gates of the city." I find it interesting that the Great Wall of China, which was built to keep the Mongols and barbarians out, was breached by invaders 4 times. And in each of those occasions, they bribed the gatekeepers to let them in. Gates are only as good as the character of the guards, right? I find it interesting in the Old Testament how our lives are referred to as walled cities. And Solomon, who said to guard our hearts, to become a gatekeeper of our hearts. So we, in effect, are all gatekeepers. We all are to guard what comes in and what goes out. John Bunyan took that and ran with it in an allegory that's not as well known as his Pilgrim's Progress, in a book called The Holy War. And it is an allegory about a city called Man's Soul. And man's soul has 5 gates. Those gates are the ear gate, the eye gate, the nose gate, the field gate, and the mouth gate. And every day in this allegory, the enemy of man's soul would come and attack or attempt to attack at one of these gates by whispering things in the ear gate or painting vivid and alluring pictures before the eye gate. And it's interesting that man's soul, in Bunyan's allegory, could never be toppled by outside attacks. The only way the enemy could take over man's soul was if one of those gates was opened by someone on the inside and the enemy allowed in. No wonder Solomon wrote, "Guard your heart, for out of it are the issues of life." Be a gatekeeper. Back in Nehemiah chapter 7, if you'll turn there, Nehemiah knew that he needed help leading the city of Jerusalem. And he mentions two men. Verse 2, I put Hananiah, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem. Now, at this point, friends, the walls are up and the gates are hinged. And someone needs to help in the leading of this city as it will soon flourish with people, as we'll see in a moment. Well, who do you look for? Well, I know who you look for. You look for a man or a few people with experience in leading. That would make sense. If you're looking for a commander of the city of Jerusalem, look for somebody who's commanding another city, who has the list in his or her resume. Find those kind of people, perhaps those who are articulate and can communicate the vision of the city. Put them in charge. It would only make sense wrong to all of those. Notice the two qualities Nehemiah was looking for in the latter part of verse 2. He was a faithful man, that would be good to underline, and here it is, feared God more than many. Faithful, feared. The word translated feared comes from the word yare. It means literally to reverence or to honor God. So when Nehemiah looked for someone to lead, he looked for someone who would honor God and be dependable, who would just show up and do the job. And what a great lesson, by the way, for the church today. It's an easy thing to apply, or any other missionary enterprise. We tend to follow the world's leading. And we look for the person to fill a role of leadership who is the CEO, who is the leader out there in the community. We look for someone to communicate within the church, and we look for those who on the outside are communicating, and we tend to stuff them into the appointments and the slots, the people that might look good on the outside, the people that might have a bearing naturally that would draw people to them. Would you notice the two qualities that Nehemiah looked for was somebody who was just dependable and somebody who loved and honored God? The next part of chapter 7 finds Nehemiah registering the citizens. And they were identified by families and clans and tribes, and they were all counted, every number given to us. Notice a few of them as we read through these credits. We'll start at verse 8 and just read a few verses. These were the only names I practiced. The sons of Parash, 2,172. The sons of Shephatiah, 372. The sons of Arah, 652. The sons of Pahath Moab, of the sons of Jeshua and Joab, 2,818. The sons of Elam, 1,254. As I read these, I thought, that's a lot of cereal and milk. Why count them so carefully? Why give us the number? Friends, they were counted by God because they counted to God. And He didn't miss a number, a name. If there was ever anybody interested in the credits, who read the credits? In fact, He is the original author of the credits. It is God Himself. In verse 39, the priests are counted and accounted for. Now, they had to prove their lineage, going all the way back to Aaron, or they would not be allowed to serve in the temple. In fact, look at verse 61 and learn with me the fate of some of these. And these were they who came up from Tel Melah, Tel Harsha, Cherub, Adon, and Immer. But they could not show their father's houses or their descendants whether they were of Israel. Verse 64, skip there. These searched among their ancestral registration, but it could not be located. They couldn't find their name in the family tree going back to Israel before the exile. Therefore, they were considered unclean and excluded from the priesthood. Men and women, you need to understand here that the people were excluded from living inside the city, who could not trace their family heritage back to pre-dispersion Israel. The priests were excluded from serving in the temple, who could not trace their lineage back to Aaron. God had a standard for owning land and having a home inside the holy city, and then for serving within the holy place, the temple. You had to have Jewish blood flowing through your veins to have a home in this city of God, and you had to track all the way back with some kind of genealogical proof that you were from the family of Aaron if you ever hoped to serve in the temple. Without that proof, without that family relationship, you couldn't live in the city, and you couldn't serve within the temple located within the city walls. I couldn't help but think as I studied this, and I want to ask you a question. What right do you have to live within the holy city the Bible calls in the book of Revelation the new Jerusalem? What right do you have to believe that you will be able to have a home in that city and serve God there? Will you be able to trace your lineage back to the family of God? Are you related? Are you a relative of God? You say, well, how do I become a part of God's family? That's what we're talking about. Well, the first step is knowing that you're not. Well, of course I'm going in there. Is your name in the registry of heaven? Jesus Christ said to me, many will stand before me on that day, and they will not only just be people who went to church, they will be leaders in the church. They will say, we prophesied in your name, and we exercised demons in your name, and we did wonderful works in your name. And Jesus will say, I never knew you. You weren't related to me. The pressing question in Nehemiah 7 and 11 on the heart of every person was the question, am I related to Israel? Can I track my family line back to the people of God? And the pressing question, men and women, on that last day, as it were, of human history is this, are you related to a Jewish carpenter named Jesus Christ? If you have received Him as your Savior at some point in your life, He wrote your name down in what Revelation calls the Lamb's Book of Life. And there's going to come a day when He's going to open that book and He's going to look for the name. And Revelation chapter 20 verse 15 says, if anyone's name was not found written in the Book of Life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Oh, it would be an awful thing in the city of Jerusalem to want to live inside the city walls, and they can't find your name. That's nothing in comparison to standing before God and wanting to live within the holy city of heaven, and He cannot find your name. How do you get your name there? How do you become a relative of God? John tells us in chapter 1, but as many as received Him, that message, that gospel saving person of Christ, you asked for Him to be your Savior at some point in your life. As many as received Him, to them He gave the right to be called children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. You got to be born again into His family if you want to get into the holy city. Now, back in chapter 7, there are people who are making donations. As I read this chapter, I think the saddest words could be the word that appears twice in chapter 7, verse 70 and verse 71. It's the word some. You ought to circle that word as a challenge to your own personal testimony and where you are in this family. Some, verse 70, from among the heads of fathers' households gave to the work. Verse 71, and some of the heads of fathers' households gave into the treasury of the work. You would think, men and women, with the fact that the city has been completed and this magnificent miracle of God's providence has taken place, that when it came time to give to the treasury of the work, everyone, it would say all. But here even it says some gave. Now, you may have noted earlier in chapter 7 that this big city has finished walls and gates that are hung, but there aren't very many people in there. If you open the gates, the wind would whistle through the streets. Who would want to move back to a city that has yet to be inhabited by anybody more than what we find here, the Chamber of Commerce and others whose job was to live in Jerusalem? Who wants to move back and start this economy and start this lifestyle in a city that there just aren't many people there? Well, Nehemiah will solve this problem two ways. Turn to chapter 11 and look at verse 1. The first way is this. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. That's the Chamber of Commerce. They had to. But the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9/10 implied were allowed to remain in the other cities. Now, we know from those who study these days that there were about 1 million Jews living around Jerusalem. So they took lots, they cast them, and 1 out of every 10 were given to the city sort of as a gift. And I imagine with any draft, perhaps, there were those who wouldn't serve, but we know that from what the record seems to indicate, they all went. There's a second group, however, that is given special notice, verse 2, and the people blessed all the men who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. The Hebrew word volunteer, Nadab, is a wonderful word. It means to be impelled by an inner urge to stand. Sort of how I feel when we sang, stand up for Jesus. It makes me stand and say, yeah, let's go. There's an inner urging, an inner compelling to stand, to be compelled, the word could be translated, to be courageous. And I love this one. It could be translated to be noble. To be noble. They stepped forward and they said, we will voluntarily uproot our families and leave our homes and life as we know it, and we will move into the city along with those that have been drafted, and we will begin this pioneering life of faith. And we will see to it that this city thrives. What better word to describe them? The noble ones. And among the noble ones is someone known for his praying. A special mention is made in verse 17 of chapter 11 of a man named Mattaniah. And Mattaniah, the son of Micah, the son of Zabdi, the son of Asaph, who was the leader in beginning the thanksgiving of prayer. What do you do, Mattaniah? Oh, I start the prayer time. No kidding. Oh, yes, and every time I do, it is a prayer of thanksgiving. He was known for praying the prayer of thanksgiving. I wondered in my own life, would I be known for praying prayers that reflect, that are filled with thanksgiving? This was this noble man. He was a Levite who stood at the appropriate time in front of the people, and he began a prayer of thanksgiving. That's what he did. And the only time he is mentioned in Scripture, this noble man is praying. Well, let me tie our thoughts together with two final principles of application. Most of the noble things, number one, you do will never be recognized on earth. In fact, there may be those who notice what you do but don't appreciate what you do, right? I get this magazine for preachers. It'd be too boring for any of you to want to read, but I get it. And preachers send in stories, and I hope they don't make them up, but... There was one story sent by a pastor from Lubbock, Texas, recently. For 25 years, he held worship services in a rest home, nursing home. When he began holding these meetings, he was a rather young pastor, and he noticed that one of the regulars who would be wheeled in would have her remote with her, television remote, and periodically while he preached, she would scowl and she would aim that remote at him and push the buttons. This went on for several months. Until finally he stopped in the middle of a sermon and he kind of laughed good-naturedly and he said, ma'am, you can't turn me off with that. And she said with a scowl, I'm not trying to turn you off. I'm trying to find a different channel. Don't dare bring remotes next Sunday. Okay, some of you guys just need an idea. I want you to know, frankly, I feel appreciated. Nobody's ever pulled a remote on me, at least not yet. Somebody today... And already have had some people say some nice things and say hello. They probably feel obligated. I don't know. But I couldn't help but wonder how many people will serve in the nursery today who will hand a baby back to a parent and never be given a word of hello or thank you. I wonder how many children will be handed over to their parents after Sunday school class without ever hearing a greeting or a thank you. I wonder how many ushers or musicians or greeters who will never be noticed, even though they have been moved in their hearts to do noble things voluntarily. The city of Jerusalem here flourished because of the gatekeepers and the guards, and we didn't even get around to them, the maintenance and grounds people and the singers and the priests and even the farmers and shepherds who contributed to the work, all pulling their weight. The truth is, men and women, that ancient city a long time ago and this contemporary church today have a lot in common. Neither one could make it for one day without many noble people who day in and day out make it happen. I can tell you from my own ministry perspective, I am surrounded by a staff of highly dedicated men and women who pull it together. If it's organized, I didn't do it. If it sounds good, I probably didn't write it. If I show up at an appointment, it was made for me and I was reminded to be there. The church, every Christian organization, every Christian cause, every missions organization is moved forward, not by a few of us who stand up in front of everybody, but by the majority of people who are not seen by most of the people, who are noble men and noble women who make it work. Notice them. Thank them. They're in the credits. And we need more of them who are willing to serve. But those who do will never be fully rewarded and noticed on earth. That leads me to the second point. While most of the noble things you do will never be recognized on earth, none, secondly, of the noble things you do on earth will go unrecognized by God in heaven. The writer of Hebrews seemed to address this. He must have been thinking about it as he said, God is not unjust so as to forget your work as you minister and continue to minister to the saints. People forget. People don't take notice. People don't say thank you. People overlook you. But God never will. He always reads the credits. Better yet, He is in the process, even today, of writing a few more to be read later at a place called the Bema Seat, where all the credits will be brought into review. I just sort of sat back in my study this week and I started thinking about all of the credits, and I want to roll a few of them here and read of noble ones who change the diapers and sweep the floors, answer the telephones and pull the weeds, arrange meetings and teach the Bible lessons, prepare the children's games and juice up the soundboard, clean the bathrooms and count the offering, those who practice the music and type the letters, pray through the list and visit the guests, cook the meals and teach the class, dust the furniture and greet the family, translate the sermon and duplicate the tapes, park the cars and get the coffee made, disciple the teenager and lead a child to a water fountain, crawl on the floor with toddlers and set up chairs in the classrooms, wash and dry the nursery linen and clean the dishes after a church activity, recruit even more volunteers or thank those who do, plan class activities and counsel at summer camp, listen to memory verses and stack the tables, unload all of the equipment and then load it back up again, only to be unloaded and then loaded up again, only to be unloaded and loaded up again and again and again and again. And know as you do it all that it is all noble work. Noble work for the people and ministry of Christ, for your family and loved ones that may go unrecognized on earth, but one day rewarded in heaven. Question is, who are you doing it for anyway, right? If it's for the attention and applause of people, forget it. They will never sit there long enough to read all of the credits as they scroll by. But if it's for the glory and pleasure of God, He will never miss one credit. He will never overlook one deed. He sees it all.